Hello and welcome to GoGo Radio, found exclusively on GoGo.com. My name is Neil Potter, and in this show we're going to discuss inspection checklists. To learn more about me and my background, be sure to check out my profile. If you have any questions you'd like to ask, please use the question and comment box below. So back in the inspection course, we discussed the use of standards and common errors checklists. And the idea was to be able to collect the wisdom of the team in a concise way and use that downstream in other inspections to find defects quicker than we had before. So if I'm an inspector and I know what common mistakes have been made by other authors and other team members, then I can find those kind of mistakes quicker because I now am aware of those items. Similarly with a standard. If you were building a document to begin with and you had a clear standard to follow, maybe one page, you would know what sections to put in there and what to look for before making those kind of mistakes in the document. And we discussed them being one page because we wanted to be concise enough to have them used. If you have a standard or a checklist that is 10-15 pages long, very few people are going to have the time and patience to go through that and verify they meet the standard or the checklist. So one page or two pages, and we just said small, is a way to focus on what you really care about and have it in a way that can be used by the team. And they really have no excuse to not look at the one page and maybe kind of find those kind of mistakes later on. So we also mentioned that every inspection you could go through and populate that with common defects and issues that you find, and then bit by bit make up your standard and checklist. You don't have to start with the previous list at the beginning. You can start with a blank sheet and then populate that over time, and then bit by bit make up a good list of what you care about from your team, and that can then be shared among other projects and then merged together with other examples. But in today's radio show, I wanted to step you ahead a little bit and show you some examples of other people's checklists which you can either copy the style of or maybe even pick out a few items which you particularly like. So if you go to the Class Materials website, which is processgroup.com/inspection-class.html, so processgroup.com/inspection-class.html, you'll find an example up there called Inspection Checklists. It's a Word document. So if you'd like to open that, we're going to go through that, some of the examples in that document right now. Now the first thing to note, this document was put together by a person called Carl Wiegers, and Carl Wiegers is a bit like myself. He's a consultant on the West Coast, and he just collected some examples from his clients of things that typically people have made mistakes in the documents, and you're welcome to use this document in any way you choose. So another thing to notice about this document, it is focused on software development and IT. So if you happen to be building user guides or doing contracts, you can make something similar to this for that type of document. So let's step through it, and I've highlighted in yellow some examples to go focus on. So the first page is a checklist for requirements. So if you're doing a requirements document, and that could be a user, could be a use case document, it could be a user story document in Scrum and Agile, it could be even a series of test cases, which are your way to capture requirements if that's what you're going to do. It could be a specification, like an SRS, that is a bit more formal in nature. But any type of requirements definition, you could build a checklist like this and use it to either capture existing defects or be able to look for new defects downstream. So I've highlighted in yellow some examples to discuss in this radio show. And of course, after the show, you're welcome to then unhighlight those and look at the document as a whole. So the first one I highlighted, it says, do the requirements provide an adequate basis for design? So if I'm a software developer and I'm about to design something, maybe a database, if the requirements are too ambiguous, that may give me too much leeway about how to do the design. If the requirement spec has no definition for performance, I could either design it one particular way and be very low performance, maybe cheap, and I could design it another way maybe more expensive, more labor involved, but has high performance. So when you look at the requirement, does it give enough clarity as a basis for doing the design activity? Are all external hardware, software, and communication interfaces defined? So the second one there is, again, very critical, because if you go through a whole phase, like a requirements phase, and altogether skip defining hardware, software, and other types of interfaces, and you get into the design, coding, testing activities, and then you discover a missing interface or an incorrect interface, then you have a lot of repair on your hands to go add that back into the system. So it's very high risk to go find that type of mistake later in the project and then go repair that. If you could find that mistake in a requirements document, it could be just 5 or 10 minutes to go repair that definition. And that way you're communicating correctly downstream to other impacted areas, those interfaces. The third one I highlighted, does the SRS or spec, software requirement spec, include all of the known customer or system needs? So if you're looking at a user story document or a backlog or a spec like this, that's noted there, do you know about requirements that are not in the document? Is there more information people know about that has not been captured yet? Because if you don't capture it now, then you have a problem of having to do that verbally downstream. So if you are going to hand off your spec to a tester to test against, or a designer or a coder to implement from, then it's really going to be a problem to have all that in your head, knowing full well that data is not in the spec at this point. Now, we're not saying the spec has to be perfect or complete. We're just saying whatever is known about, the spec should reflect that to avoid communication problems later on. If you go a bit further down in the document, and we go down to the end of the page one, one of the items there is, are all requirements actually requirements, not design or implementation solutions? Now, one good point about a good spec is that you don't overly constrain the designer or the implementer with items that are not part of the requirements. They should be allowed to come up with their own design that supports a particular requirement. And if you do put design information in there or design suggestions in there, then you could either be overly constraining the designer or even guiding them to the wrong point. If you say this is a system and has these four features and it should be in two databases, but the idea about two databases is erroneous, and in fact it doesn't have to be two databases, it could be any number, then if the designer picks up on that and believes that's a requirement, they may be going down one particular path in their project, and that particular idea about the databases was not even a requirement in the project. So be very careful about putting extra stuff in a requirement spec that is not an absolute requirement, because that could cause problems downstream in people doing things or not doing them, and then having to kind of backtrack over that later on. So cleaning up the spec during an inspection is actually a very good use of the team's time to take out those type of issues. If you go down to page two, page two discusses a checklist for architecture design reviews. So if you have an architecture defined, which could be a diagram, or it could be a textual document or a mixture, one of the items I highlighted there are all possible states or cases considered. So for example, if you have a system you're building and it has particular states it exists in, like a website, if you design a website, it has states it goes through, which are the screens you are then clicking on to change its state, are all possible states considered. So consider a system where it has particular states it could exist in. And so for example, a website has states. If you have a web page being displayed and you click on a link, it goes to another state. Click on the other link, it goes back to the previous state. So when you look at a system that has that kind of a characteristic, have you considered all states? If I'm in one page of the website and I click on a foreign link, one that is not common to that page, what happens? If I want to go backwards, can I go backwards? So are you considering all the states in the architecture the system could then take on during implementation and running? Clarity, are there multiple consistent representations of the design? A common mistake made by teams is where they have a graphical version of the design and a textual version of the design, and they don't match. Maybe one person updated the graphical version, but did not go back and update the textual version. So when the design has more than one way to describe it, did you keep those ideas consistent with each other? If you look at the next page, which is the high-level design review, which is page 3, I picked out a couple of there. First one, are error messages unique and meaningful? It would be a good time in the design phase to capture design issues where the error being displayed on the screen is not comprehensible by the user. Just saying there's a system error code 52 is not a good error message to display, because that particular code may not be known by the end user. They have no idea what to do next. So at the design phase, you may want to capture or trap some of these type of defects where error messages are going to be displayed, but they're not particularly well defined or clear to an end user. Have all security considerations been designed? If you haven't been looking at the design of security in your system at this point, it could be too late for that. Getting down to implementation and testing, it would be very hard to then consider security issues in the system, where data is stored, how data is purged, who has access to data, whether you can log into the system by a firewall or not. Those kind of issues are really at the design phase, and things that are good to capture at this particular point in an inspection. And if you look at next page, detailed design, page 4, I picked out two examples there. It's all data-defined data. So if you go to the next page, on page 4, about detailed design, the first one there is all defined data used. So for example, did you define a particular data structure and never use it? And could that be confusing to the next developer that has to maintain the system? So if you have data that's been defined and never used by anybody in the program or the suite, then that could be a problem downstream. Either they're going to use it by mistake, or they're not going to use it and they should be using it. And then, are defaults used and are they correct? So if we have menus or options in the system and they have defaults provided already, to avoid the system crashing with incorrect data, incorrect inputs, are those defaults defined and are they correct as defined? And then go down to the next page for code reviews. So go down to the next page for code reviews. The first one, are symbolics used rather than magic numbers and constants? So if you're a developer, you know having fixed numbers in a program can cause problems, because unless it's a variable you can change easily, then to kind of find all those instances where you use that number could be a major maintenance headache. And are there inconsistencies between code and comments? So having, obviously, comments is a good idea, but if they don't match what the code is doing, then either the code could be wrong or the comment could be wrong. Again, making it very hard to either fix or maintain later on. And if we could skip down to the test plan reviews, page 6, have all pass-fail criteria been defined? So at least from a test planning standpoint, you'd expect the requirements to have been defined from a pass-fail standpoint, so the tester knows what to look for when he or she tests. And the last one, last page, project plan reviews. I picked out two there. Are all assumptions that went into the project planning clearly stated? So the project plan may be very good, but it may suggest a particular approach or a particular style of doing the project, and the assumptions based upon may not have been declared. So maybe the assumptions are correct and they are not known to the reader of the document. So just to avoid having to hash out that verbally every time, it could be worth clarifying the assumptions were and then list them. And secondly, if you have the wrong assumptions, You'd want people to know about that at the beginning, and therefore declaring them in a plan and having the plan inspected is a way to clarify bad assumptions as being incorrect and have those repaired before they're too late. So if you assumed it must be on a particular platform, or you assumed that a hardware device must be used, but that wasn't true, it'd be better to declare that in a plan and have that corrected than to nobody know about that and then be a surprise downstream. And the second one I picked there are all estimates documented along with the method used for deriving them. So estimation, the technique you're going to use should be declared, then the reader knows how credible the numbers actually are. It could be a very early estimate and therefore not that credible. They know there's a revision coming on later on. It could be a very credible estimate, but they have no idea how credible. So if you put, for example, this estimate was derived using historical data, previous data, or this estimate was derived using planning poker, a particular method for estimation, or wideband Delphi, that gives the reader a lot more idea about how to use the numbers and how good they are, compared to you saying this estimate is a wild guess, or this estimate is a first cut ballpark guess, but further estimates are kind of coming later. So just clarifying the history behind the estimate gives the reader a lot better information about what they're looking at and how to use the numbers in the document. So there's some examples of common errors checklists and things that could become standards. Again, they're just a checklist style, and your job will be to maybe pick out a couple of things you like and then work with your team with your list and then decide which ones are potentially standard items and which ones are then common errors in your type of work. So I hope you enjoyed today's presentation. If you have any questions or comments, please use the question and comment box below. If you are interested in viewing my other shows, just search GoGo Radio Archives for Neil Potter, P-O-T-T-E-R. And if there's a show you would like me to do, please send me an email and let me know. Thanks for your time today, and remember to tune in to GoGo Radio, found exclusively on gogo.com.